So it's my pleasure to welcome you to this event organized by the WED Research Group. The context for the event is almost self-evident, and it's perfectly timed, not very long now before the Glen Eagles summit, the G8 summit, which is the focus of worldwide and domestic attention, with the focus on poverty in the context of Live 8, Make Poverty History, and more. The facts are legion, and we shall hear about them. You can trot them out, and sometimes they can seem very empty of meaning. 30,000 children dying every day in Africa. 40 million refugee children as a result of premature deaths in their parents, who are living in very great difficulty. Living standards falling. Millions of people on less than a dollar a day. A very complex set of social, economic, personal, family, and communal difficulties that are a huge challenge. And it's some of that that we're going to be looking at this evening with our panelists here. It's taking the form of a radio program with which I'm associated called Any Questions. If you've never heard of it, it doesn't really matter, it's pretty straightforward. Basically, we have asked people to submit questions. They've been selected from the list that came in to cover the range of issues that I think you will think are central to the potential solutions or non-solutions to the crisis of global poverty. I'm going to ask in a moment our four panelists briefly to introduce themselves. When the questions come in, they'll deal with the questions for a while. I might ask a few clarifying questions of them, and then it'll be over to you on each question. I'd ask you to deal specifically, if you want to raise points or make points, specifically with the question that has been put or the debate that has just been had between this quartet. Don't move on to other issues, because we'll be coming to them in the course of the hour and a half that we've got for this event. Also, if you make your points really succinctly, it helps, because it allows more people to get in. So don't go off on one, unless you really feel strongly, in which case I should probably stop you. I may not, depends how good it is. Let me now ask, therefore, one by one, our panel to introduce themselves, starting here on the left with Alistair McGregor. Briefly, brief CV and why you're here.
Okay, my name is Alistair McGregor. I'm a lecturer at the University of Bath and have been researching poverty and policy for the past 20 years or more, specifically in South Asia and more recently in Southeast Asia. But in the Wellbeing in Developing Countries research project, we are carrying out a program of research across four countries, in Peru, in Ethiopia, in Bangladesh, and Thailand. And the purpose of the research really is to understand why some countries and some people in some countries remain poor, despite aid efforts and the efforts of governments and non-governmental organizations to address poverty over the last 30 to 40 years.
Thank you. Joe?
I'm a journalist who's been writing about Southern Africa for 30 years. I'm now a lecturer at the Open University, where I've just written a new course which we're presenting called War Intervention and Development, which is looking at roots of civil war, post-war intervention. But what I'm really interested in, why I'm here tonight, is issues of how do you get more money to poor people in Africa?
Thank you. Tajuddin Abdul Rahim.
Tajuddin Abdul Rahim. I'm a director for Justice Africa and also general secretary of the Pan-African Movement. I'm here because anything that concerns Africa concerns me. It's not a theoretical or professional issue. It affects me. But also, I'm here because people in Bath University have me on their address book. Unlike Bob Geldof, who couldn't find African musicians in his address book.
And Duncan Green.
Evening, my name's Duncan Green. I'm head of research at Oxfam. I've got a background as a writer and researcher on Latin America, Asia, and now on more global issues. I'm here because this is a massive year for Oxfam. We're very involved in everything going on around the G8, around Gleneagles and the Make Poverty History campaign, and also because my mum lives in Bath and it's her birthday today, so it was just a fantastic
opportunity. Happy birthday.
Happy birthday to her.
And she's over there, but I won't make her stand up.
Right, let's get underway with our first question, please, which comes from Beverly Ashton.
When she speaks on television, Bob Geldof seems to equate poverty with insufficient food. But a charity appeal I received this morning from Oxfam equates it with lack of education and healthcare. What do the panel members understand by the term poverty?
Just to kick us off, what do you understand by the term poverty? Duncan Green.
It's a surprisingly difficult question to answer. When you actually ask poor people how they experience their poverty, they don't normally say, I earn less than $1 a day, which is the kind of definition the World Bank uses. They say, when I go to see local officials, they demand bribes. I get beaten up when I go out on the streets. I feel insecure. I feel anxious. There's a whole range of issues about education, health. So I think, in theory, everybody these days accepts that there's a very broad definition of poverty. The trouble is that in practice, politicians tend to just narrow it down to that $1 a day. And I think you lose a lot of what is the richness of people's lives when you just focus on the $1 a day.
Alistair McGregor.
I think the elements all come together. One of the most obvious and striking features of poverty is where people aren't able to command enough food to eat. But we also need to understand poverty in terms of the processes that produce it. And that involves the systematic denial of participation in education. It involves inadequate or inaccessible health care for many people. So we need to understand poverty both as a set of outcomes in terms of what people are not able to enjoy or experience in their lives, but also understand the processes that produce it. Because those processes are vitally important to understand if we are going to intervene to make a change, make a difference.
But before we go on to the processes, if you can conceptualise poverty and have a feeling for what poverty is, for instance, in the United Kingdom, can you also have a feeling for what poverty is in, say, Ethiopia, Bangladesh, or many other countries in the developing world?
I think there are common elements to poverty in all countries around the world. I think the fundamental aspects of not having enough food, not having enough food for your children, and then the trade-offs that people have to make in order to just achieve the bare minimum, whether in Peru or in Ethiopia, are strikingly similar.
Tajuddin.
Well, as a political scientist, my take on poverty is, first, it is relative. Secondly, it's about power. Poor people have no power, and they have no power because they are poor. So it's about power relations within communities, within societies, between countries. But then also you have poverty in relations between countries, that African countries are poor in relation, you know, to the dominant powers, you know, internationally. It's about your access, you know, to the basic needs that makes a human being to survive with dignity and in freedom. And collectively also, it's about your ability to influence your lives for the better.
And Johan?
The poor are poor because they don't have money. And it's as simple as that. You have to start from making sure people have enough money to get food, to send their children to school. Poverty is fundamentally lack of money, but it is also lack of money because money has been taken away from people. People have been impoverished, and that is the process that we really need to challenge, and that is about the lack of power. But I think we always need to come back to that single point, people are poor because they don't have money, not because they're stupid, not because they're incompetent, not because they're drunk, but because they don't have money. So when we try to help poor people, we help them only by giving them money, not by telling them how to behave better.
Any thoughts in addition to those definitions of poverty that you want to add to or subtract from? What is poverty? Bath has poverty in this city. It certainly does. As it happens, it does. It's often thought to be a very well-off city, and there's a lot of people who are very well-off. But if you look at the indices in this city, they are very similar to other towns and cities around the United Kingdom, proportionally, for poverty and all the other social problems that flow from that. Any thoughts on it? Yes, at the back. Would you mind just standing up when you so that others can see you?
Yeah, I think the distinction I draw between, say, poverty in Bath and in England and poverty abroad is that poor people abroad have to walk umpteen miles to get fresh water, a handful of grain. We don't have to do that here.
As a neutral chairman, I have to say I'm really glad that you made that point, which I was looking forward to hearing. We'll go on to our next question on that basis, please, which comes from Dr. Mahinda Digali. Have I pronounced it right? Digal or Digali? Digali.
If certain religious and cultural values are seen to be complicit with poverty, should the poor be encouraged to abandon those values?
If certain religious and cultural values, if certain religious and cultural values are seen as complicit with poverty, should people be encouraged to abandon those values to be free of poverty? Who would like to kick off on that? Joe?
I think so, because if you look at the value of our society, the most important cultural value of our society is that some people should be very rich, and that by implication other people should be very poor. And I think that the first thing that we have to do is abandon that cultural value and move to the cultural values of some other societies which have more interest in equity.
What about the word religious in this? I mean, is it self-evident that, say, the Anglican faith shares that cultural value that you've described?
The Anglican faith is the rich at prayer. It's always described as the rich at prayer.
I mean, well, there will be Anglicans, I guess, in this audience who will say to themselves, hang about, that there is a lot in the Bible that is about looking after the poor and the sick and the halt and the maimed.
But I think that the way religion tends to be interpreted in Europe, at least, and the United States, if you look at increasing fundamentalist values in the United States, is closely allied to a capitalist economic system, which is freedom of the individual to become rich. And I think that we have lost a much deeper spiritual value, which is built into Christianity, of sharing, of equity. And I think that the cultural value which has become dominant in the post-Thatcher years is of inequality, and that's the cultural value that we need to abandon.
Duncan, you, I think I'm right, used to, before you joining Oxfam at one point, you worked for one of the many charitable organisations, NGOs, that is based on the Catholic faith, or born out of the Catholic faith.
Thank you for pointing that out. Yes, and I think the question that concerns me is, should we encourage the poor to abandon that faith? I think if the faith is not responding to the poor's needs on all those different levels we talked about in terms of the experience of poverty, the poor will decide and move elsewhere. So when you see in Latin America is that the Catholic Church has in many cases been abandoned by people moving to the evangelical churches because the evangelical churches were speaking to their needs. So I think actually the poor get up and move, and that's better than us deciding who is complicit, who is not complicit, and doing encouraging about which religion you should be in. So I'd be happier to leave it to the poor to decide.
But isn't there quite compelling evidence that actually people who are living in poverty very often, for better, for worse, find redemption, find comfort, find strength in religions, and therefore to be neutral about it, if you are also of the view that the religions themselves are a negative force, leaves you slightly sitting on a fence?
Yes, I will sit on the fence on this one, but I think it comes down to whether you think the poor are subjects who decide or whether they're objects of brainwashing. And in my experience, the poor are very seldom objects of brainwashing, and they do decide and they do shift and they do move around. And therefore, it's better to stay with the poor than to stay with your own view of particular religions. But it is true that when you ask the poor who they trust, top of the list comes religions, and I'm afraid, Jonathan, bottom of the list comes journalists. And that seems to be almost a worldwide phenomenon.
There are some interesting... They've done some further research on that, which shows, incidentally, that if it depends what newspaper you work for or broadcasting institution. There is a broadcasting institution, which I won't even name, uh-huh. And if you work for it, it comes just behind priests at the top. And politicians and journalists on other newspapers come just at the bottom... And in front of them, I think I'm right in the last frame, people who are involved in the buying and selling of houses. So there you are. Tajuddin, you, yes. You come from a country, Nigeria, which has been stricken by immense religious cultural strife. And it is also both rich and poor.
Well, you see, a famous philosopher who is not readily quoted these days, said religion is the opium of the masses. And, you know, the thing with religion is that it's either those who have and those who have nothing. Both have a void that they have to fill. So if God did not exist, we would have invented him. But, you see, it is more the manipulation of religion to strengthen the power of those who already control society. These days in the West, it's fashionable to talk about Islamic fundamentalism. Nobody talks about Christian fundamentalism. I come from Nigeria. You arrive in Lagos, a city of 15 million people, and every other building is a church. And reactionary churches that actually blame the victim. You are poor because you have sinned against God. You have AIDS because you have sinned. And surprisingly, you have a flock that is very poor, but the priest is very rich. You know? So, you know, people are financing their own poverty through this mirage of seeking some kind of spiritual liberation. But at the end of the day, anywhere in Africa where you talk of religious conflicts, you know, the basic underlying factor in this conflict is poverty. You know, and that, for me, any religion that does not seek to liberate people, you know, from the poverty of their condition, but rather keeps them there and let them suspend their liberation to some outside forces when the poverty is man-made and can be man-cured, I think it needs re-examining. So I'm calling for religious, Africans are very religious people, but I'm saying we should take our beliefs in a way in which it improves our lives rather than make us docile.
Alistair.
I think the issue of culture and religion is one of the big taboo areas in respect of making poverty history that we really need to address and need to debate and discuss openly. I think the danger of all of that is the notion that challenging any other cultures or belief systems involves supplanting it with a superior or better set of cultural values. I think what we need to look at in each situation is to look at in what ways the cultural systems and belief systems are implicated in the reproduction of poverty. And certainly I would, from my own experience, argue that there are many situations around the world where these cultural practices or cultural beliefs are implicated and need to be challenged.
Is a belief in the virtue of democracy a cultural attitude?
I think the belief... I think democracy is a word we can use very lightly. I think what is important is a belief in the ability for people to debate and to evaluate the way that their society needs to change.
They should be left to do that within that society.
I think if societies have got systems that enable people to actually move on to question belief systems, cultural practices, then that's probably the best
solution.
What
systems make that possible, and what make it impossible?
I think there are many traditional systems that have operated, which do allow a certain amount of debate, but we've already raised the issue of power, and a key aspect of power, especially at local levels, is the inhibition of debate and the inhibition of the ability to challenge practices and to take them on. They may be valuable to people, and we should be very, very circumspect in the way that we engage. We all engage with each other's belief systems, and there is a certain amount of respect to be had, but they're not untouchable.
I bet there'll be some thoughts about that. Do you want to, you put this very interesting question, Dr. Degali. Do you want to have a quick expression of your own view?
I was just wondering, because I think religions try to help poor, but I think they do it in different ways. And also I think there's issue of cultural values, like for Sri Lanka, for example, acquisition of wealth seen as something greediness.
Seen as something
acquisition of wealth will be seen as lack of simplicity or greed. And so our gentleman there said that lack of wealth is the problem. And so how can you kind of harmonize these religious values where it says that, you know, you shouldn't accumulate wealth, where it is necessary to accumulate wealth, you know, the contradiction.
Do you believe that injunction to accumulate wealth, which I suppose is part of development in national or international terms, is as it were, forgive me, to pursue a false god?
I didn't understand, I'm sorry.
Is the injunction, the encouragement to pursue wealth, yeah. We heard that, you know, religion is at the service of the rich.
Yeah.
There is the injustices and inequalities between nations and between West and developing countries, for instance, is usually couched in language about allowing or encouraging or participating in a process that will deliver greater wealth to those poorer countries. Do you believe that the pursuit of wealth is a good thing, or do you, as what I interpreted you as saying, it's a false god to pursue wealth?
Personally, I think there's nothing wrong pursuit of wealth. I mean, it depends on how you use it. And so I think it's necessary to acquire wealth. But there are religious understandings that certain religious traditions say that simplicity is better, so you should use little, like small is beautiful. So I think, personally, I think wealth is a good thing, and it depends on how you use it. And if you use it efficiently, then it can make the well-being of the people.
Any other thoughts from the floor? Over there.
I got the feeling that religion was almost viewed negatively to this point, but surely many religions in the West, especially the Christian religion, actually go out of their way to help the poor. And indeed, there's always been corruption in religion, and I agree with that. And there will probably be corruption in countries that there is corruption anyway. But surely it is the governments that are in charge of the people that are more to blame for this corruption and for problems with this rather than religion, which goes out of its way to help the poor.
Just on that specific point, so we'll come on to corruption, but I'll come to you, Tajuddin, but Duncan, you work for an organisation which, if I'm right, draws a huge proportion of its support from various faith communities in this country and internationally.
Yeah, if you look, for example, at Jubilee 2000, the debt campaign at the end of the 90s, that was built on churchgoers, and the reason why it had such a political impact is that many of the people demonstrating outside the last G8 we had in the UK, which was in Birmingham, were churchgoers, were not your normal student demonstrator. Many of them had never been on a march or a demonstration in their lives, and that had much more impact on the politicians and led to a big debt relief deal. So I think that's clear. I mean, I don't think this is an attack on religion. I think part of the discussion about wealth creation is actually, if we get back to what we were saying earlier about poverty, that it's about powerlessness. If religion increases people's sense of power over their own lives, then it's reducing poverty. And if it makes people feel less power over their own lives, then it's a problem. But I think if we get stuck on wealth and poverty, on wealth and income, then you lose that sense of being empowered by religion, which is what you see in many poor communities.
I mean, I'm Tajuddin Abdulrahim. Nobody needs to tell you that I'm a Muslim. But you know,
You're practicing. You're a practicing Muslim, as opposed to being merely born into Islam.
Born into it, and I hope I have no reason to change it. Whether I practice it, that is left to God. Now, I think let's look at Latin America. You know, in the 70s, liberation theology, how actually the church, you know, a radical interpretation, you know, of the scriptures in favor of the poor, actually helped, you know, in opening up social transformation. And I think this is possible in any religion, be it Islam, be it Christianity, Buddhism, or whatever religion you aspire to. I think the relationship of churches and mosques, you know, to power is the key issue. You know, when those who are in power seize religion, they will interpret it in their own image and use the ideology to keep the people where they are. So it is a challenge to religious people to actually, this business of serving the poor, what about exploiting the poor? There is no point in saying religion helps the poor if you do not address a system that actually makes the oppression and exploitation of the poor possible. And in whatever we do in life, we must be able to raise our voice in support of the poor.
Against that background, power, poverty, faith, not faith, the predicament, we come up to date, or we move towards where we are now in policy, political terms, I think, with a question from Fiona Remnant. Fiona, would you put your hand up the microphone's getting
Hi. I'm coordinator of the Bath Oxfam group, just to put this in context. The Make Poverty History campaign is demanding three things: more and better aid, drop the debt, and trade justice. Which of the three demands do the panellists think is the most important to make progress on at this year's G8 meeting?
Of the three demands of the Make Poverty History campaign, more and better aid, drop the debt, and trade justice, which of those three do the panellists think is the most important to make progress at this G8 meeting? Oxfam start off on this, Duncan.
This wasn't a plant, this question. Okay? There's no doubt in my mind that the key issue is trade. No country develops through aid or debt. Countries develop through trade in the long term. That they need to have a fair chance to trade with regions like the US or Europe who cheat in terms of the trade rules. They need to be protected from the kind of subsidized products which pour out of Europe and get dumped into Africa and other developing countries. So they need a chance to have a go at trading their way out of poverty. The aid and debt are crucial steps in freeing countries to be able to do that. The only sort of caveat on that is the G8 doesn't normally make many big decisions on trade. It has much more power to decide on aid and debt. So I think what we'll see this year is a big discussion on aid and debt in Gleneagles, and then a massive discussion on trade at in December, when the World Trade Organization has one of its periodic punch-ups in Hong Kong. And I think that will be the kind of end of the year, and it's only then that we'll know how much success or not we've had on the whole Make Poverty History agenda.
I mean, I think the three of them are not the right question, because they are all tied around, especially the aid and the debt, are tied around increased conditionalities, which make it harder and harder for poor countries to get out of poverty.
Could you just, for those who aren't familiar with the concept of conditionality?
Right. When debt is...
I'm not going to ask you to put up your hands, those who aren't absolutely clear what conditionality is.
For example, the debt cancellation for poor countries will be conditional on further privatizations, further openings to foreign, particularly foreign companies.
Each of these conditions which has been imposed on aid over the past 20 years has made it harder and harder for countries to get out of poverty, so that we give with one hand and take with the other. And I think that it's that cycle which we're repeating at the G8 meeting. The point about trade, in a sense, is yes, these countries need to be able to trade out of poverty, but most of the trade gains are going to go to Latin America, not to the poorest in Africa. So trade is not going to be a great deal of help to the very poorest. But I think we have to start rethinking. We've ended up with an agenda at the G8 which simply increases this huge machine which administers aid and debt relief and doesn't actually reduce poverty.
Would you go so far as to say therefore, because on the face of it, it's implicit, why bother to talk about making poverty history? Why bother to have a G8? Why bother to have a Live 8, etc.? Why bother to engage? Because it's all up the spout?
No, but I think we've gotten waylaid, we've gotten caught up in a process which the politicians are prepared to accept. And by looking at what will the politicians do, we've ended up by asking for things or demanding things that aren't very useful. And so I think we should have done a Make Poverty History, but a Make Poverty History that would actually make serious demands about freeing up poor countries to be able to pursue economic strategies which would allow them to develop. What we end up with instead is, yes, we'll cancel a little bit more debt, but will require you to do things that will make you borrow more money and get deeper in debt. And each time we've done debt, I was policy officer for Jubilee 2000, so I've been part of this whole process. And our failure with Jubilee 2000 is that the debt cancellation was so wrapped up in conditions that the poor countries had to keep borrowing more money. And so they've gotten deeper in debt again. And I think that we...
Could you argue that the success of Jubilee 2000 is that it put debt into the public consciousness where it hadn't been before, that pressure gave people who knew about these things much more authority to examine closely exactly what you described, which has led to a situation where debt is not, if it is conditional, is not nearly so conditional because it's a total write-off?
I think we succeeded in putting international finance on the agenda, but I think where we failed was they were able, the other side, the World Bank, the IMF, the people who are dealing with these things, were able to take that away from us and say, fine, we'll give you debt cancellation, but we'll impose so much more restrictions on poor countries that we will stop them from getting, we will stop them from making effective use of that debt cancellation.
What for you of the three we were asked is the most important, Alistair McGregor?
It's one part of it. It's the better aid part of it. All three are absolutely necessary. More money, an improvement in how developing countries are able to spend their money are important, but if they're swimming against the tide in terms of a huge burden of debt, in terms of injustices in respect of their trade, then it will all come to naught. And that's my big fear for this year and this time and this mobilisation. Huge amount of public awareness in Britain. The politicians are on board. Gordon Brown is going around and he's raising the money. But are we actually going to see a difference? Is it going to make a difference? So this question of better aid, yes, we can give more aid, but is it actually going to make the difference in terms of the poverty of the people in the developing countries? And I think this brings us four square round to issues of governance in developing countries and our relationship as a bilateral aid giver, but also as part of the multilateral scene, our relationship to the governance of the countries that are going to be the targets of the effort and the mobilisation.
I want to just bring in another question which follows very closely from that before I bring you in, if that's possible. Ipshita Basu.
Is foreign aid a mere bandage to cover the wider problem of impoverishment, injustice, and inequality that is created by a West-led neo-colonial international order and unfair trade practices?
For those who think that the acoustics aren't so great in here, in fact they're tragic, usually the acoustics in this place, is foreign aid a mere bandage to cover the wider problem
of impoverishment, injustice and inequality. We heard Alistair saying that the aid thing was the most important, or they qualified that. Is it just a product of the Western-led neo-colonial international order and unfair trade practices? So it's a mere bandage, is the question. Which, just to add into the, which of the three is the most important?
Well, I will reformulate what your question actually as a statement and say I agree. But I actually have a counter to the make history poverty, which is make aid poverty. Because aid empowers Westerners in our affairs. And it gives unaccountable power to institutions like that of Duncan, you know, Oxfam, ActionAid, and all the big ones, you know, to play God in Africa. Secondly, aid has never developed any society. Development must be out of our own effort. Look, there are more poor people head per head in India and China than there are in Africa. Just take absolute numbers. But nobody talks about saving India or saving China. Why? Because China is seen in the context of being a big power this millennium. India is seen to be able to solve its own problem. When tsunami happened and everybody was busybodies were going, India said, hold it, we can solve our own problems. Africa is vulnerable because we are disunited. We are scattered in 54 ugly states that are not reformable. So, unless we put our own house in order, whether you triple aid, you make it 10 times, it is not going to help us. But it frees liberal conscience in the West that we are doing something. Issue of debt.
Let's stick with that for a second on this aid thing. Yes. I'll let you come back in on there. But just so I think, Duncan Green, you may want to respond a little bit, as you've been charged with playing God and assuaging your liberal conscience.
Yeah, I was working for God at CAFOD, and now I'm playing God at Oxfam. So I'm not even a Christian.
Aid, basically, you're saying, don't send us aid, please. No. We don't want aid.
Okay. There's a phrase which is used about aid, which is, it's just money down a rat hole. And I was looking on Google to find out where this first was used. And it was first used by an American senator about the Marshall Plan. The Marshall Plan was the money which is now worth about $75 billion in current day, which the US poured into Europe after the Second World War, and it was a crucial part of rebuilding a Europe which was on the verge of starvation. Aid of the right kind at the right time works. Korea and Taiwan started their economic takeoff with plentiful amounts of aid, the right kind of aid. So I don't think it's aid is good or aid is bad, it's which kinds of aid are effective and which kinds are not. And I think it is crucial that aid is part of helping, doing essentially what Taj was saying, that aid has to be part of a process of Africans taking matters into their own hand. If the aid is undercutting that, then it's not going to work. If the aid is contributing to that, which is what most of the Oxfam aid does, then it's part of the solution, not part of the problem.
And Joe, you think that aid is the most important of the three, almost the only valid one, yes?
No, I mean, first of all, I want to agree with the statement. Of course aid is a bandage. You look at ActionAid, for instance, just did a study which came out last week, which estimates that we take $700 billion a year from poor countries and we give them back $65 billion in aid. In other words, we give back 10% of what we take. That is impoverishing Africa. That is impoverishing the developing world. So the first thing is actually to stop impoverishing people. Now, yes, it's to soothe our consciences that we give them back a little bit. Now, but I do want to pick up something that Duncan said, which is that if you look at Europe after the Second World War and the Marshall Plan and the World Bank, original World Bank aid was for Europe, and Korea and Taiwan and other countries where aid has been successful, the key point was that those countries could determine their own economic policy. And if you look at Europe after the Second World War, what is striking is every European country developed a different strategy using that Marshall Plan aid. And a whole range of strategies were developed, but they were able to develop their own strategies. We do not allow Africa or Latin America to develop their own development strategies. We micromanage those countries. And we keep making decisions which don't work. When you look at post-war countries, I've been writing about post-war countries, What they have said to countries from, what the World Bank has said to Sierra Leone and to Mozambique is, we're sorry, you cannot follow the strategy that was used in Europe after the Second World War, because our theory is that it shouldn't have worked in Europe. And because it shouldn't have worked in Europe, we won't let you do it. Now, this is madness. So we're saying to Sierra Leone, you have to stay impoverished because you're already poor. This is what the IMF says, that the amount that you can spend of aid is dependent on your current income. So the poorest countries spend the least money. Mozambique's post-war development was delayed by nearly 10 years because the IMF stopped it from spending aid money. They said, don't rebuild the bridges that had been blown up. Don't rebuild the roads because it will be inflationary. This is not what we did in Europe. What we did in Europe was we rebuilt very quickly. Now, when the international community is saying to Africa, follow strategies which have never worked, but which ought to theoretically work, but don't follow strategies which did work, but theoretically shouldn't, something's wrong. So that we have to change the whole aid mechanism to let countries make a few of their own decisions, at least.
At the risk of being wrong as frequently, aren't you slightly out of date? Because if I understand it correctly, and I may be wrong, it was precisely in Mozambique particularly, because the World Bank IMF terms were so intolerable, leading to the Mozambique government, which had some extremely good mother and child programs, having to abandon those mother and child programs so that the under five death rate went up. It is now the case that the aid to Mozambique is no longer constrained by those same terms. It is not... what I'm suggesting is that if you did a snapshot, yes, you would say it was pretty bad, but actually it's rather better than it was, precisely because people like yourself have been pointing out why that aid was not being adequately free for Mozambique to use. And if I'm also right, a conversation I was having the other day with the Chancellor in specifically, Mozambique is saying, we're not going to have anything if it's on IMF and on World Bank terms, but Mozambique is getting the money because it has taken that stand, and it is free to do with that aid what it wants.
No, on two grounds. One is I've just recently been doing some work in Sierra Leone, which has also...
We're talking about Mozambique.
No, let me finish. What is interesting about Sierra Leone is that the IMF is imposing the same policy in Sierra Leone that it imposed in Mozambique 10 years ago, which we've now accepted was wrong. So they're imposing the same policy. In Mozambique, the same cap on spending that applies everywhere means Mozambique is not allowed to hire enough teachers to meet the Millennium Development Goals. So here we say the Millennium Development Goals require universal primary education, but the IMF says, no, your government salary cap is such that you can't hire enough teachers to meet those goals. So no, Mozambique has not been changed. The IMF is still running the same set of very rigid... They did ease off a little bit, but not very much. And they haven't changed their strategy because they're still imposing the same strategy in post-war countries. We're going to get another war.
We mustn't go down the Mozambique road, but you will concede that the IMF proportion of aid, if you take into account bilateral aid, World Bank aid, and the other multilateral agencies is not the overwhelming proportion.
No, but all aid to Mozambique is conditional on having an IMF program. Mm. If you look at Britain's agreement with Sierra Leone, for instance, line number one is you will have an IMF program. Almost all donors require that countries, including Britain, require that countries have IMF programs. So the IMF sets caps on how much aid can be used. And it's those restrictions, so that Britain can be wonderful and generous and say, oh, we don't impose any restrictions. All we require is that you meet the IMF restrictions. It's the IMF that says, well, Mozambique and Sierra Leone can't meet the Millennium Development Goals because they can't hire enough teachers.
Yes. Before I know you're coming in on debt, I haven't forgotten, but just on this, you've got a word to add on this, Alistair.
Well, I'm going to come back to something that Joe said earlier and take issue with, which is we take this amount, the large amount, and return a small amount, which is very much germane to the question why aid looks like a kind of sticking plaster. I think what that question does for me is bring it back home, the debate about how does our aid programme, how does all this effort relate to the rest of how we behave in Britain in terms of our politics and our action? It's great to see big politicians up there talking about it, but can they join it all up? We're seeing little snippets of it when Mr. Blair is brought into debates over the Common Agricultural Policy, but it wasn't really happening much before they asked for the rebate back. Equally, you know, the Labour government started off with a very bold idea. It was going to talk about ethical foreign policy. And the idea of ethical foreign policy has disappeared. So the big issue of the we is, yes, developing countries and some people in developing countries are making huge amounts of money through their relationships with developing countries. Other people genuinely believe that they are trying to make a difference, trying to work and do things. But the system is so tremendously out of kilter. And we don't seem to be able to have the debates here about how we get the DTI connected up with DFID and how we get DFID even to engage in public debate. We asked them to come here tonight to talk about how the many millions of dollars and pounds that Gordon Brown is going to mobilise might be made more effective, but they're not here. They don't come out and they don't talk to us enough.
I should have said earlier, DFID, we expected them to be here until last week. They claim that that the G8 has got in the way. It is not unclear. It's not totally clear to me whether that is an explanation that would win many prizes. But probably would win a prize or two is that the MP for Bath, Don Foster, would have been here, but he is on a three-line whip, which is why he isn't. I'm still waiting to come to you, Taj, but I'm going to go, first of all, just on this aid thing for a quick pick-up from Duncan.
Just one sort of cautionary note, which is I think progressives, NGOs, the left, have a terrible problem with winning. Every time we win something, we think, oh, we've been co-opted, or we've made a terrible mistake, or that we've been had. And we're really much happier with losing. And I think what you actually find is we're winning quite a few small things, and we have to accept that the debate on aid is a shifting one. So actually, we have made some progress on these conditions that Joe talks about. And we mustn't assume that the World Bank or the IMF is all-powerful and all-knowing. They're just as confused as we are half the time, and it's actually a kind of fluid battle, and we have to be more self-confident about what we know is right and what we're demanding.
Final yes. thought on the which are the three most important. We got into the aid debate. Back yes. now to the other one that you wanted to say about debt.
Yes, but something. One sentence on Duncan's. Yes, I take the criticism that sometimes when we're winning, we don't know we're winning because we're used to being in opposition. But also, you should know what you are winning. For instance, Tony Blair and his government ignored over 1 million demonstrations in this country, when they were demonstrating for him not to go to war on Iraq. Suddenly now, the government is doing everything to support this demonstration on Glenagos. Does that mean they love African children more than they love the Iraqi ones? I think people also must be careful in terms of the alliances that they make. And I think there is a risk in this country that NGOs, big NGOs in this country, think they are in bed with New Labour. And I think that is a legitimate criticism and people have to watch out. Now, debt and trade. I say, that the debt, debt relief is important. Debt cancellation is the issue. And it has to be universal in order for it to make sense, to the development of Africa. But for me, I say, make aid history. Make fair trade the future. Because every statistic tells you, out of £1,000 put into Africa, over £1,500 get out. Who is aiding whom? I don't know the situation in Bath, but I know in London, if Nigerians, Zimbabweans, Sierra Leoneans, and Liberians stop working in the NHS, many hospitals will not operate. There are more Malawian doctors in Birmingham than there are in the whole of Zambia. So now, who is aiding whom? I think there are ways in which, fair trade, because there is no point. Aid is about you slapping me and then offering me a handkerchief to wipe my tears. You are confused as to whether you should whack the person back or say thank you for the handkerchief. So for me, fair trade is the future. Because if African countries can get the, you know, the problem with African economy is that we produce what we do not consume, we consume what we do not produce, and the price of both is determined from outside of Africa. Unless you reform that, debt cancellation will not be sustainable, and aid will not be sustainable.
In a phrase, because everyone uses the term fair trade,
yes.
What to you is fair trade? We heard earlier Joe say that the problem with fair trade is that it'll be great for Latin America, but that Africa will go down the tubes in fair trade because it doesn't produce at the level of the value added that Latin America is. I'm just expanding the thought.
Yeah, you
what
know,
is, what you is,
see,
what is fair trade?
You know, because, I mean, we can go into the economics of fair trade. I mean, fair trade means African countries, whatever they are producing, they are able to determine the price. Just like we don't determine the price of all the imports that we get. It is determined by those who produce it. But what we produce is also determined, you know, from outside. And there are so many other things that Africans have. For me, my starting point is always in terms of
you cannot possibly be saying that if you're a coffee producing
yes.
country where there's a world glut, well, we're setting our price at this amount, and if you don't buy it, well, that's your hard luck. When some other country is saying, well, we're setting ours at half that price
yes.
because you won't sell any.
Yes, you see, that is why I always put the foot back on Africa. Actually, Africans need to be trading with themselves. You know, open up Africa. You know, we are globalizing without Africanizing. This is a problem. You know, that why should there be surplus food in Uganda when people are dying of starvation in neighboring Ethiopia or Eritrea? Why should food parcels be dropped from here? So there are so many things. Before Africa can take advantage of fair trade, debt cancellation, or aid, there are so many things that we need to put in order amongst ourselves.
Johan.
There was actually an agreement on coffee called the International Coffee Agreement, under which producers and consumers set a higher price for coffee, which made sure that peasant producers in Rwanda and other places got a decent price for their coffee in Colombia. And the United States unilaterally said, that means our consumers are paying too much for coffee. And so the United States unilaterally destroyed the International Coffee Agreement. And the wars in Colombia and Rwanda are both a direct result of that, because peasants became impoverished. In Colombia, they turned to producing cocaine instead of coffee. And in Rwanda, they started fighting among themselves. But it was an agreement which was working until the U.S. unilaterally said, we won't pay that for coffee. So we had fair trade, and it was destroyed.
I'm going to move on to Rachel Breard, who has our next question. Rachel? Rachel, do you hear?
Yes. Should aid be withheld from countries such as Zimbabwe that are ruled by governments culpable in keeping their people in poverty and misery?
Should aid be withheld from Zimbabwe? Taj?
Yes.
Right. I think that may be the shortest
answer. No. But I want to pose a different thing. So should it be withdrawn from Uzbekistan?
Yes.
So should it be, you know, Zimbabwe is just the pariah of the moment. The West is busy, you know, they can look, you get a discount on human rights, good governance, and all these things that are preached to us if you are on the right side. And especially now with this war against terrorism that knows no boundary and knows no end. You know, if you pledge yourself on the other, you know, firmly in that group, you can get a discount on other things. I am very vocal in terms of the human rights abuses of the government of Zimbabwe. But as bad as you may think it is, there are worse governments, you know, in the world that are not taking the same kind of pressure. And it is this hypocrisy, this double standard that the West needs to address itself to, not to cherry pick, you know, which dictator they support and which the dictator is the one that you can talk today. Who is now talking about human rights in Libya? Libya has come in from the cold.
Alistair.
Yes, I fully agree with Tajuddin. I think the a fundamental part that I've mentioned earlier is governance, is the issue of the relationship between the people and their government, their state. But as Tajuddin also points out, the double-sided, the double-handedness of it, where it fits into the geopolitics. I think a basic condition in terms of making more aid, better aid, is to address the issues of the relationship between people and their governments. And if those can't be sorted out, then the issue of giving of aid should be a non-starter.
Duncan.
Who decides? Yeah. I mean, who decides which government is not going to get aid, is which government is going to get boycotted? This is something we talk about all the time in the NGOs, which is, okay, you know, at one point there were you could barely go shopping because everything was being boycotted, right? Now, what we decided was that you need a kind of system for deciding who has overstepped the mark. And the best way is that the people of the country, a representative body in the country, calls for a boycott. And the same process should go for aid. Now, if the situation...
What constitutes a representative body? In a country like Zimbabwe, how would you identify that representative body?
It's not an exact science, but in Burma, for example, the National League for Democracy, Aung San Suu Kyi's, you try and find at least a loud voice within the country that's calling for it. That's one check. Now, it may well be that the system is so bad that it's impossible to constitute an opposition voice like that in a country. Then you look around, you look in the region, you look at peers, you look at the sort of the Africa Union system or the NEPAD system or different ways that neighbouring countries can have a voice. I think the last person you believe, to be honest, is the US or the UK in this, the US-UK governments. You have to have a system which brings you as close as possible to a legitimate voice saying, yes, things are so bad, we want you to actually stop aid in this country.
Does that mean in the case of Zimbabwe that you would or you wouldn't stop aid to Zimbabwe?
I think there's enough voices from Africa and enough voices within Zimbabwe to make a case for stopping aid to Zimbabwe, yes. The other issue, sorry, within that is what kind of measures you take. There's much more targeted measures where you're actually clearly punishing Mugabe and not punishing the rest of ordinary Zimbabweans, like travel bans and that kind of thing. So those should be the first way in rather than just go for a blanket ban.
Joe.
I think it's the wrong question. I want to go back to what Tajuddin was saying. If you look at the Uzbekistan page on the World Bank website, I think still, the only thing that is wrong with Uzbekistan, it is not friendly enough to business. They can boil people in oil, but they're not friendly enough to business. If you go back with Zimbabwe, when the first problems arose in Zimbabwe, the World Bank continued to support, the international community continued to support Mugabe because he agreed to a structural adjustment program. So when the people in Zimbabwe were saying, hey, we don't like this, when Mugabe was sending his troops into then Zaire, oh, that's all right because he has a structural adjustment program and he's doing what the World Bank and the IMF wants. By the time we get to the mess now, we're saying, what should we do? It's too late for us to do anything sensible there. It really is. We should have dealt with this before. And I think we always need to look ahead. We need to look. People have been campaigning on Uzbekistan now for several years. And the World Bank just simply didn't listen. So money went into Uzbekistan. Now, I think we have to back up and not say, what do we do now? Do we stop aid now? We have to think about how we're interacting with the elites, with the governments in these countries. And saying, and if you look at Uganda, we've been allowing Museveni to wage war in the north of Uganda for a decade now. And saying, oh, well, he's a nice man. We're not going to bother with that. We don't put any pressure on him. We don't say anything public about that. In Mozambique, which I write about, Chissano, great hero of the donors, has been involved in assassinating at least two people and stealing large amounts of money. Now, or at least as alleged. I have to be always careful about libel here as a journalist. But it is alleged that his family is involved, and the donors, including DFID. It's interesting that DFID has led the donors in not raising this issue, has blocked the donors from raising this issue collectively with the government of Mozambique. So when Mozambique comes unstuck, we will say, oh, should we stop aid to Mozambique? We should have been dealing with this 5 years ago already.
Given that we are where we are now, and people have to make judgments about where we are against the background, conceivably, that you've just described, are you saying that you take a decision to withhold or not to withhold aid on a case-by-case basis. Do you say in the case of Zimbabwe that you do or you don't? In the case of Uzbekistan, Tajikistan? I mean, there are an awful lot of these countries, as you rightly point out.
I think, first of all, you start with a public debate. You go public. You don't do this in secret.
Yeah, okay.
You say...
Let's process, but let's assume that you have this debate, right? And now everyone has come to agree with your view about what ought to happen. What happens?
I'm sorry, I...
You won't answer that.
I won't answer that because I think it's the wrong question. We always deal with the mess after we've created it. Let's try not to create some messes. Let's start to deal with... If we had dealt with Uzbekistan, we pull our ambassador out of Uzbekistan because he starts to raise these things publicly. That's backwards. We should be putting our support in there and saying, yes, we support what you're saying. Yes, we want this raised. And so long as we in donor countries are not prepared to challenge this, we'll always end up with messes where we have to make an impossible decision.
Taj, can I just ask you a question, if I can, which arises out of what you said before about Africa trading with itself, as it were. As an African, are you frustrated or not, given your views about the human rights situation in Zimbabwe, it's an issue that's often raised, by the failure of South Africa, with its power and influence, to openly express criticism of Mugabe?
That's not true. South Africa has been critical of Zimbabwe. The African Union, even the African Union's Human Rights Committee, even issued an official report condemning some of the atrocities in Zimbabwe. What South Africa and Thabo Mbeki has refused to do is to be a Trojan horse for the British, who have no moral or political right to do all this. You see, there is a distortion here. Because Western politicians and Westerners in general think that they are the only ones who have a constituency, that African politicians don't have constituency to respond to. There is a racial issue in Zimbabwe. In the 80s, the government of ZANU went into Matabele land. Thousands of black people were killed there. There wasn't much uproar. Let's face it, Zimbabwe is making the news because of the settler connection. Because African lives are worth nothing. And Africans deplore that hypocrisy. And in the case of Zimbabwe, Sowetan newspaper is the largest, black newspaper in South Africa, has carried opinion poll upon opinion poll where Mugabe is more popular among blacks in South Africa than he is even in Zimbabwe. Why? Because in South Africa, the issue of land, how would you take it if black people owned 75% of Bath? It's a critical issue. My criticism of Zimbabwe is not on the land issue. It is the process in which Mugabe, as a last-ditch attempt, is using it in order to perpetuate himself, in power. But we have to address this land issue.
That's a really interesting question. Let me ask, because most people here do come from Bath. There are many black people living in Bath of different nationalities and British citizenship as well. Who would mind if the majority of Bath was in the ownership of people from another ethnic group? Who would mind? Would you put your hands up? People don't want to put their hands up.
It's not politically correct to put your hands up. That's all. Okay.
Who doesn't give a monkey so long as the public services work more effectively, so long as money isn't wasted, and so long as there's jobs? Who doesn't mind? Who owns? Who doesn't mind who owns? Who's thinking about it?
You phrased that question unfairly.
Yes.
Because if the question were, suppose 3/4 of Bath were owned by people who said, all right, you who are in this audience cannot live in the houses that I own, yes, cannot shop in the shops that,
yes,
I own. You have to move out. That's a different thing. Of course.
Who's saying that where else in the world at the moment?
Because white-owned farms in, yes, Zimbabwe mean that the vast majority of the people in Zimbabwe did not have access to land. Mm. That's the same as saying in Bath, okay, the majority of Bath cannot live in the houses that exist here. You have to form a squatter settlement out in the hills somewhere on the outside.
So are you, can I ask you, because your analysis sometimes, which is riveting, sometimes leads you to conclusions and sometimes it doesn't. Yeah. Do you have some sympathy with the Mugabe policy on land in Zimbabwe?
I have no sympathy with Mugabe at all, but I do understand the land issue.
Yes.
And I think what you have to do, but you have to keep going back. Britain at Lancaster House
yes.
promised Mugabe money for land resettlement, which it never paid. This goes back to 1981. So that the whole problem, the World Bank, my friends, the World Bank, I was writing about Zimbabwe, I was a journalist in Zimbabwe at the time. The World Bank said, we will not allow you the money to resettle. They had a program, in fact, a very good program, which resettled 60,000 families by agreement. They were going to expand it. Britain said, no, we will not give you the money we promised. And the World Bank said, we will not allow you to assist the farmers who are resettled. So that it meant that the farmers would not have, and so at that point it was stopped because they knew the mess that ended up was going to be created. So we stopped one of the best resettlement programs that would have avoided this because we didn't want to see white farms taken away. We, Britain, DFID. Now, it wasn't DFID then, it was the Foreign Office. And we have to remember this history. We always look at the snapshot of, yes, there is a mess in Zimbabwe now. Yes, there is a mess in Uzbekistan now. We have helped to create these messes, and we have to intervene at a different level. We have to say, okay, we should have supported land reform in Zimbabwe 20 years ago when they had a good program that was by agreement, and we said, no, we're not going to support land reform then. And we end up with what has happened, and I think we have to take some responsibility for what has been created since. I should say one other thing about Matabele land. Also, I was there at the time. It was interesting that the British aid agencies who were working in Zimbabwe at the time suppressed a number of reports on Matabele land, on the massacres in Matabele land, saying we don't want to rock the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the British aid industry also has a certain responsibility for cover-up in Matabele land. And there's a lot of reaction of aid workers in Zimbabwe at the time saying, oh, our headquarters in London are not allowing us
okay.
to publish reports.
Let me there's no reason why you should know specifically that, but it is often said, it's often alleged most of all by journalists, from time to time, the agencies, the NGOs, Duncan, not necessarily yours, but in general, are very good, if it's inconvenient, at stopping journalists finding out what is actually happening, which I think is the general point that you could draw. Is that true? Do you find there is a tension between those who wish to discover what is going on, maybe not getting it exactly right, and what the work you're trying to do on the ground, which involves you working with government, working with other organisations? Is there a tension there?
I don't think I've seen evidence of suppressing, trying to stop journalists getting hold of information. The area of, if you like, caution is on going public on issues when that will actually destroy your ability to work in the country. And that's a balancing act, for example, that the NGOs working in Sudan on Darfur, if they go too far in criticising the government, they're out, and the refugee work they're doing is destroyed. But if they want to go as far as they can because they need political change in the Sudan. So that kind of politics does exist, and I think it's inevitable.
Any thoughts on this so far? From what you've heard so far, or are you so wrapped? Yes, we have lots of thoughts. Over there, first of all, about yes, and then guy here with the glasses and the blue check shirt who's in the same row.
Following on from that, it does seem to me that one of the key issues here is institutional memory, and I'm delighted to see some people whose memories go back 20 years or experience goes back, because there is a real danger in a new lot coming in and thinking they're, you know, doing something great. We've already done it once and made mistakes. But I think there is a real issue about access to information, and I think that Zimbabwe example is a good one, in that we are very dominated we're very influenced by what information we receive, and that is dependent on which countries our journalists find it easy to go and report on. And it goes back to the issue that the gentleman said, well, you know, why aren't we worrying about China or India? One reason, certainly in China, is actually it's very difficult to get information. And I think also, as somebody who's lived both in the UK and in America, the information received is very different, and so often the disagreements between our politicians or what we as the voting public believe is very seriously influenced by our medias, and you know, therefore that influences, you know, how we do aid or how effective our aid is. But that question so far hasn't really come up. I think the information and, you know, freedom of press and so on is very important.
Thank you very much. And the man who was just along from me, I think, with glasses on, wanted up. Oh, sorry, it's in this row here. Sorry, with glasses and...
From the...
Would you mind standing as well so others can... You don't have to.
Sorry. From what we've heard this evening...
A little bit closer.
It would appear that the panellists don't have a great deal of respect for the IMF or the World Bank. And I was wondering what they feel is needed in regard to these organisations. Is it evolution or revolution? Do we abandon them or do we improve them?
There we are. Quick one. So, well, you've probably been the most critical, so, but I'll bring you in first. Joe, what would you do with them? Evolution, revolution?
Well, the IMF should be abolished. It has no function because its function dates back to the era when there were fixed exchange rates, and it has never found a job since then.
So it's revolution for
the IMF. We need a development bank. We need a World Development Bank that will get resources into countries. The problem is that the World Bank has become not a bank or a development agency, but it's become a gatekeeper. And it's become an all-powerful institution. So either you have to restructure it. I mean, Walden Bellow, for instance, has argued for abolishing the World Bank but going down to regional development banks. That might be a solution. But we do need mechanisms which will transfer capital. And so the World Bank, up for grabs whether you abolish it or...
And given that the power in the World Bank springs partly from the main donors and principally from the United States, would you restructure the World Bank to deliver the kind of organisation that would deliver that support in the way that you've been describing so far?
Well, I think what I would actually do is accept the main argument of the World Bank, which is that competition is the most important thing. There should be a free market. So we need a dozen development banks, not one World Bank. The World Bank doesn't work because it violates its own standards. It's a monopoly. So we need a dozen development banks and let them compete.
Alistair, what do you do with them? Evolution, revolution?
I think the World Bank is one of the most opaque and difficult to understand organisations in terms of its governance and the representation of countries in it. And I think until it changes to reflect a kind of democratic, a more democratic structure in which developing countries have got a serious voice, then expecting it to perform the role that it claims is unrealistic. But I want to bring us back to just one other thing. A couple of months ago in London, there was a wonderful big glossy event, which was the BBC World Trust and DFID getting together to celebrate what they could do together to sort out or sort of give impetus to this year. Jeffrey Sachs up on the table, Gordon Brown was there talking about it. Absolutely wonderful. What the BBC can do and what journalists can do is actually focus on some of these decisions that are being made at the time. It's really hard to get development issues on the agenda for debate and discussion. So when the difficult decisions are being made historically with governments like Museveni's in Uganda, yeah, he seemed to be doing a lot of good things and he's hopeful, so we'll stick with him. But it's all going wrong bit by bit and difficult decisions are not being made, but they're not being debated. So I think a really crucial issue in all of this is about public scrutiny, public debate, the media performing its role and actually highlighting where these decisions are being made. And as for the World Bank, that too being opened up to some form of public debate and scrutiny.
Reform, revolution, Taj?
Definitely it's just between reform and revolution. It should be revolutionized.
Okay.
But how do we do it? I think they need to be democratized. You see, these institutions are controlled by unelected people, and most of them unelectable. And, you know, why must the World Bank head be an American? And the IMF one has to be European. You see, when people talk, the West is busy preaching good governance and democracy to everybody else. What about global governance? You know, we need to democratize global institutions, the UN, the IMF, the World Bank, the WTO, and all of this, because power is in the hands of a clique of powerful states.
in which the poorer countries of the world, who are the majority of the peoples of the world, do not have a say. So whatever you do, you know, you must return to that democracy. And I like Joseph's subversive loyalty, you know, of saying that let there be competition of different kinds of democratic institutions so that the people of the world have choices rather than us being controlled by organizations that are Stalinist in their prescriptions and the way in which they operate.
Dan Green?
Why is there only one monopolies commission? That's the question. The problem with development is really difficult. No one has this magic recipe for doing development. And what you need is a range of options for countries so they can try things, they can fail, they can learn as they go along. The World Bank suppresses discussion, suppresses debate. It thinks it knows the answer even though it never works. And it's amazingly stubborn about not learning, and the IMF is even worse. So I think there's a real problem about the impact they have on development at the moment. The changes I would make is the IMF needs to go back to doing what it was supposed to do, which is act as a lender of last resort when countries are in big financial crises. And the bank needs to change its voting structure. The UN is one country, one vote. The bank and the fund are $1, one vote. However much you put into them is your voting share, which gives a disproportionate share of the vote to the richer countries. And above all, they should move their offices out of Washington to Nairobi or Kinshasa or somewhere else. And that would just radically change the nature of the institution.
I'm going to go on to my next, from Chris Hogg. Up you stand, Chris, if you would.
Okay, if I must.
you didn't have to.
I'll sit down again. what should be done and by who so that debt cancellation, aid and increased income from trade does not result in the strengthening of corrupt, oppressive regimes, but in the reduction of poverty?
How can you avoid strengthening corrupt and oppressive regimes by whatever means, debt cancellation, all the other things that we've been discussing? How do you avoid strengthening them rather than attacking poverty effectively? Would you say, Alistair?
I think you have to look at where regimes are responsible for the reproduction of poverty. I think you have to I come back to this point about bringing some ethics back in to the relationships that we have around aid. I think if a system of governance is implicated, just as a system of culture or a system of beliefs is implicated in the reproduction of poverty, then I think that's where then aid should take issue with that. It should not be given to situations where the structure of governance is actually prolonging and deepening poverty for people. So I think we actually need, Gordon, Duncan was saying, well, how do we spot these things? I think we actually need some principles that we're looking at in terms of the governance of people, the corruption of the regimes that we're dealing with.
Sorry, who we have a United Nations. It has a charter. It has a whole host of principles. The principles are violated regularly by the member countries who come together to establish whether or not those principles are being adhered to. So how do you achieve your objectives? Through the UN or through some other body or individual countries making decisions according to their own lights?
No, I think I think in certain aspects the United Nations is also a source of despair in terms of its operation, its ability to kind of operate its own principles. I think there are increasingly movements of people in countries. There are also international organisations, Transparency International. We've known long the work of Amnesty International. And of course it gets into conflicts with government because they don't like to hear it. But these are the issues that actually, if we're going to deal in terms of supporting regimes, in handing over budget support to governments, most recently and most difficultly in Ethiopia, for example, you know, can we honestly say that we're going to hand over that money and expect the government, with its current constituency, its current political constituency and political arrangements, to actually spend that money in a way that's going to make a difference?
Magna Desai at LSE made a radical suggestion. He said, there are 50 billion poor people in the world. We
Sorry, there are a billion poor people in the world. We give $50 billion a year in aid. Why don't we just give all of them a dollar a week and be done with it? Now, I've actually done some research, and that's a perfectly practical suggestion. You could actually do that. I think poor people are more likely to make better use of that than corrupt governments that we want to back. The problem is that we have all of these institutions like Oxfam and the DFID and so on that employ literally hundreds of thousands of people. We have a major aid industry which is dependent on our handling aid this way. And the aid industry makes its links with elites in the countries that we're dealing with. And these elites are the corrupt ones, so they're not going to bypass the corrupt elites. But it would be perfectly reasonable to take all of the proposed aid that we are saying we want to give to Africa, all the increase, and just hand it out, a dollar a week a person. And
regardless
of
income, not means tested.
We don't means test child benefit here. If you look at Africa, 80% of Africa is poor. So why are you going to means test? It will cost you more to means test to keep out the other 20%. Okay. Just give everybody a dollar a week and be done with it.
Dollar a week? I think you ought to come to your own defence, Duncan Green.
Again.
Sorry.
It's tough working for Oxfam. I don't recognise that description of Oxfam. I don't think we rush into a poor country and say, right, where's the elite? That's who we want to work with. That's not what we do in the Sudan. That's not what we do all over Africa. There's some difficult realities about corruption. One is that actually corruption tends to be higher in low-income countries and tends to fall as countries get richer. Mayor Daley was extremely corrupt in the U.S. He didn't stop the U.S. developing. There were plenty of corruption tends to fall with time as the economy gets bigger and countries become more developed. Some of the difficult evidence, which actually Oxfam doesn't like to talk about because it's really difficult to wrangle with, is all the econometrics, economic studies are. It actually doesn't matter. In the words of Bob Geldof, give them the effing money. Because actually, whatever the institutional regime, whatever the problems of corruption and governance, actually aid tends to lead to growth and that tends to lead to poverty reduction. We don't say that very publicly, but that is what the evidence from the economists says.
Isn't it, there are economists in the same principle who say that in this country, the black economy, where people are under the law behaving corruptly by being part of the black economy, is a huge engine of economic growth and development in this country in exactly the same way.
Quite possibly, yes. Yeah.
Anyway,
one other aspect to aid.
Tajuddin.
No, can I just have one more?
Quick one.
Aid can actually be part of the solution if it's the right kind of aid. We fund people in Malawi to go around checking that the school textbooks, which aid's paid for, have actually arrived in the school. We fund anti-corruption campaigns. We fund people who monitor government budgets. There's lots of things that aid can do on a smaller scale to actually make sure that the big aid is used properly.
Taj.
Yeah, let me begin by correcting Jonathan. There's nothing called black economy. In PC terms, it's parallel economy.
I stand corrected.
Okay. Now, you see, this issue of corruption, there's nothing African about corruption. And capitalism without corruption, I don't know where it will stand. And, Enron and all that kind of things, have really put that in sharp relief. And always, when people talk about corruption, it's about our corrupt African governments and African leaders. The city of London is a citadel of looted assets, from Africa. Why are we not talking about the connection? And actually, as a critic of the Blair Commission report, that is one aspect of the report that I actually endorse, because for the first time, a major, Western intervention approach actually addresses corruption, from both ends. The Western companies, Mobutu stole all those money. Where are those money kept? In Swiss banks, in Paris, in London, in France. The same thing, Abacha, in Nigeria, the billions. When it comes to African governments actually trying to repatriate some of these assets, we are told banking confidentialities. And I think these are areas in which people really have to address themselves. I always make a jab at the Blair Commission. When they launched it, it was launched in the British Museum. And I said they could have begun from British Museum. Go downstairs and you see all sorts of looted treasures from Africa. Blair could have shown us that he meant some business by saying, I'm returning these things. And that way you can challenge the rest of the world to do better or match what the British, you know, can do. That does not mean that I'm defending corruption in Africa, but I'm saying the nature of power and the economy is such that there are givers and there are takers, and you have to deal at both, you know, at both ends. And there is something in called New Partnership for Africa's Development, NEPAD, which actually introduces a new concept called mutual accountability. In the past, it is always about the West saying, do this, do that, and monitoring us, evaluating us. There's a whole industry, you know, attached to the NGOs that are feeding fat, you know, on Africa's misery. But now you say, okay, you review us, and we also review. We also review you in a mutually accountable way as to the uses of investment and of aid. And I think in that direction, I mean, people should listen more and talk less when it comes, you know, to dealing, you know, with Africa. Africans are not just sitting out there. They also have their own alternatives. And I think trying to help, you should stop this mentality of saving Africa without Africans. If Africans do not save themselves, there is nothing your help can do. So it helps to listen to what they are doing, how they want to do it, and where your intervention can help or cannot. Sometimes doing nothing is the best you can do.
Had this been a live program, we would now have been taken off air unceremoniously because we're over our time just. We started a little bit late. We could have taken a lot of other questions, not least about conflict and about the amount of money that is exported in the form of weapons as aid. But I'm not going to go there. We could do it. I'm going to have just one last question, which comes from James Nugent. James. Where's James Nugent?
I'd like to know whether the panel believes that those people Bob Geldof is encouraging to go to Edinburgh would be better, especially given the quote of direct quote of Bob Geldof of just give them the effing money, whether they'd be better to just donate the cost of their train ticket and accommodation to a poverty relief charity.
And you carried on rather than annoying the residents of Edinburgh and doubtless the areas surrounding Gleneagles. What is your own view on this first? Do you think they would do better?
Just give them the effing money.
Basically, it's a simple broad question. It's about public concern, public engagement, and so on. Do you welcome the fact, if I'm not distorting this, do you welcome the fact that Bob Geldof is saying go to Edinburgh, and do you support people going to Edinburgh, or should they give the money that they would have spent on their train ticket or bus ticket or whatever? What do you think about that? Who wants to start on that one? Alistair.
I think the demonstration, the making public of the debate is extremely important. Yes, the government has had a tremendous ability to ignore large numbers of people mobilised on particular debates. But I think there's an ongoing momentum here, which I hope can be maintained, and I think Edinburgh and Gleneagles are part of that. So people going, yes, give the money, but people going and actually showing politicians here, showing politicians more globally, that actually it does mean something to people here is particularly important.
Joe?
I think political pressure is essential, and therefore I think demonstrations like Edinburgh are essential. I don't like the campaign, I don't like what it's doing, but I think the whole nature of political pressure getting a large number of people there is important. But I think it's important for another reason, because it's easy to stick your hand in your pocket and throw a few shillings in the tin and be done with it. If you go on an event like that, you talk to people and you talk to other people and you're debating those issues, and it's the time that you're spending that deepens your own understanding of these issues, and hopefully then you'll keep campaigning afterwards. And I think it's keeping that pressure up. In a way, this is a follow-on from Jubilee 2000, for instance, and that's the people who were in Birmingham 7 years ago who kept campaigning. And I think that's the point of going to Edinburgh. It's that you don't stop with going to Edinburgh. It's not like going to the Edinburgh Festival. It's because you want to keep campaigning and keep up the pressure.
Duncan.
I was just trying to do some sums. I don't think people have got that much effing money. If you think how much debt relief they got in Birmingham, it works out at several hundred thousand dollars per person, per demonstrator. Aid, as given by the public, is vital, but it's small potatoes compared with the kind of things that our leaders can agree. So yep. Go to Edinburgh.
Go to Edinburgh. And we've got three in favour of going to Edinburgh. Taj.
I'm a supporter of public demonstration, coming from a tradition of championing of lost causes. And I think also that much as I have suspicions about the political agenda, you know, of the British government in encouraging this demonstration, I think, for me, the test of it, like Joe said, is not just going to Edinburgh. It's not carrying your Make Poverty History wristband. It is actually what happens after Edinburgh, because this issue will not, you know, Africa is not a fashion, you see, you know, that is in flavor at the moment, and then, you know, tomorrow you get another flavor from Tesco or Sainsbury. I think people, the positive thing I've seen from Geldof 20 years ago and now is that actually the campaign has shifted away from give us your effing money into actually the structural issues, the linking of aid and trade, you know, and debt. And I think that is where real change, you know, can come, if we can sustain, you know, the momentum. You know, politicians don't react and let people put continuous pressure, you know, on them. Go to Edinburgh if you can, but even if you can, keep the pressure wherever you are. Every little bit counts.
I'm going to ask our audience, just out of curiosity, with a show of hands, is anyone here going to Edinburgh? Would you put your hands up so we could see? Well, if that's reflected across the country, given the size of this audience, it will be more than the million. who may not be going? Who, to go back to the question, who likes the idea that lots of people are going to Edinburgh in the ways that we've been hearing about? Who likes the idea? Would you put your hands up? Well, there's a pretty large, there's hardly any hand that hasn't gone up. I would simply add from my own part that over 30 years ago, when the then General Secretary of the United Nations pointed out that Africa was going backwards economically, it made a few headlines in the kind of newspapers that most people don't read, and that was that. Today, when we point out exactly the same thing in economic terms, there really is a debate of the kind that we've been hearing here. The thing that I kind of get from this discussion, something I strongly believe as well, is that there are no simple, neat answers. What matters is the debate. That's absolutely fundamental. If we have the debate, we learn, we discover, we don't necessarily agree, but we make things matter. And if you make things matter, things can happen. That said, thank you very much, everyone, for coming. I hope you've enjoyed it and it's been useful. And thanks to our panelists.